January 25th, 2016, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9, Text 18. Yasma bibhanya hamapi dviparada dishnam adyashita saka laloka namaskritam yat te peta po bahu savo vararut samanas tasmai namo bhagavate diyamakayat tasmai namo bhagavate diyamakyatubhyam. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Your Lordship, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, who are indefatigable time and the enjoyer of all sacrifices. Although I am situated in an abode which will continue to exist for a time duration of 2 paradas, although I am the leader of all other planets in the universe, and although I have undergone many, many years of penance for self-realization, still I offer my respects unto you. Purport. Brahma is the greatest personality in the universe because he has the longest duration of life. He is the most respectable personality because of his penance, influence, prestige, etc. And still he has to offer his respectful obeisances unto the Lord. Therefore, it is incumbent upon all others who are far, far below the standard of Brahma to do as he did and offer respects as a matter of duty. Yasmad bibhanyaham api dviparadadishnyam adyashita sakalaloka namaskritam yat te pe tapo bahusavo varurut samanas tasmai namo bhagavate dimyakyajubhyam. Your Lordship, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you who are indefatigable time and the enjoyer of all sacrifices. Although I am situated in an abode which will continue to exist for a time duration of 2 paradas, although I am the leader of all other planets in the universe, and although I have undergone many, many years of penance for self-realization, still I offer my respects unto you. So Prabhupada says in this purport that if Lord Brahma is offering respects to the Lord, to Krishna, even though Lord Brahma is so qualified, then what to speak of everybody else? The Lord Brahma is the most qualified person in the universe. So all of us should offer our respects to Krishna as a matter of duty, Prabhupada says. So what do we mean by duty? It's a word that's used a lot in the Shastra. It's a word that Srila Prabhupada uses a lot. When I first read the Bhagavad Gita, I was 17 years old. I was a university student. And I kept coming to the phrase prescribed duties. Every time I would come to that phrase in Srila Prabhupada's translation of Bhagavad Gita as it is, I would hesitate. What are prescribed duties? What does that mean? Prescribed by whom? Prescribed by what? You know, prescribed duties means they're given by somebody, right? Who's prescribing them? What are my duties? I mean, perhaps if I had lived 100 or 200 years ago, I wouldn't have had so many problems knowing what a prescribed duty was. But in the 1970s, I just really didn't have a clue as to what it meant at all. I hadn't grown up in any kind of an environment that talked about prescribed duties. I mean, okay, if you're working for a company, then you have your prescribed duties by the company or in your family. You know, you have a job of putting away the dishes on Monday night or something like that. But in general, I couldn't understand what it meant by prescribed duties. Who is prescribing? And in fact, this is a general question that we get. What are my duties? Scribing means to write. Prescribed. They've already been written. It's kind of like, what's my destiny? What's the job that I have to do? You know, sometimes when people have near-death experiences, the higher entities throw them back in their body and say, you still have work to do. And generally, the people take it in a little bit of an arrogant way. Well, yes, I have some very important things to do on the planet. It may simply mean you still have some karma that you have to experience in this particular body, so you can't leave it quite yet. You know, it's like you still have some years left in your prison term here. It may not be quite so complimentary. Mm-hmm. But what is this? What do we mean? You know, prescribed, already written duty. Again, already written by whom? Who wrote it? Did I write it? So there's a growing class of people who claim that we decided our own destiny, that when the time between lifetimes we consult with the higher entities and we decide, okay, what kind of body we're going to have and what our duties are going to be. Well, they say it's written by us. And then there are people who say it's written by us in this life. They say we decide what our duty is, we decide what we want to do, we make all of our own decisions. And you know, we contract, and then we fulfill the terms of that contract. When that contract's over, we get a new contract, and we have contract with, you know, spoken or unspoken, written or verbal with various entities. Somebody may say, well, it's the family that prescribes. I mean, certainly when we're children, our family may give us different chores to do. Maybe we have to, as I say, put away the dishes on Wednesday night, or we have to take out the trash on Saturday morning, or things like that. So those are prescribed by our family. Then we have duties prescribed by our country. So most countries of the world say when you're young, you have to go to school. When you're working, you have to pay taxes. Now, those are duties that you have to do. You're expected to be engaged in some honest labor. The government, most governments of the world today, not all by any means, but most, will give you money if you're not able to work. But you're expected to work. Expected that a capable adult person will have some kind of source of income from which they pay taxes. Some countries have a prescribed duty of military service. And when I was young, the United States had a draft, and all men between the ages of 18 and something had to, they were forced, they were conscripted, we have this word again, script, they were conscripted into the military. And it's still like that in many countries of the world today. And then there may be prescribed duties according to the religion. So we're born into a family, and families often, not always, but often they have some religion, and they may have prescribed duties according to the religion. So at this day of the week, at this time, you perform this ritual, you go to this gathering of believers, and you say these particular prayers, and you have certain duties within the religion. Interestingly enough, even in the modern secular society, secular means where you divorce God from your vision and understanding of the world, but even in the modern secular society, there's kind of a secular religion, right? There's different holidays, so I don't know about in other countries, but in America, you know, we have our Independence Day. Most countries have some day about the founding of their country, and then people, I mean, it's not obligatory, but it's expected that you're going to celebrate that day in some way. You're going to go see the local fireworks, and families may have certain duties like that in relationship to secular festivals and secular observances. You know, you have to put a pumpkin on your doorway for Halloween, and you have to make a pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving, and you have to put lights on your house for Christmas and things like that. So that may be a kind of religion, one could say, by the family. And then we already talked about ourselves. So, but who decides? This is the first big question. Who decides what the duty is? Who is it that's prescribing? And then what do we mean by duty? Now, duty seems to have the connotation of something very dry and difficult and unwanted. That's generally how we use the word in modern English. So we could say, well, you know, I don't really want to take my mom out shopping, but it's my duty. You know, her car is broken. It's my duty to take care of her. What we're saying in that case is it's not something I would have chosen to do if I didn't have some feeling of duty. I wouldn't voluntarily say, oh, I'd love to spend my time taking my mother out shopping. And we use duty in that sense. Well, we use duty perhaps in a little bit more positive sense. You know, it's a duty to maintain your family. It's a duty to feed your children. Implying that, of course, you want to feed your children, that good parents don't want their children to starve. At the same time, there's a sense of that you have to do it even on a particular day when you may not feel like it. You know, it's not that every single day the parents necessarily feel like preparing meals for their children and the children throw the food across the room. I remember babysitting one little boy many years ago. Now he's like in his 30s. But anyway, I remember babysitting him when he was a very young little baby. And he threw his food, his prasadam, all over the room so that the entire room needed to be cleaned, the walls, the floor. And I told the parents, I'm not babysitting this child again. So it's not that the parents necessarily want to do that several times a day, but they do it as a matter of duty. So on one hand, they want it. They want their children to eat. They enjoy feeding their children. They want their mother to be taken care of, so there's some level of voluntary want in there, but still there's also some level of duty. So this all seems very burdensome. You know, somebody decides what it is that I have to do, what are my obligations, and then I have to do it whether I like it or not. You know, if I can find a way to like it, well, all right, but I'm certainly not expected to like it, I'm just expected to do it. And there will be consequences for doing it or not doing it. If I do my duty that's been prescribed by me, by my authorities, then my authorities will be pleased with me. They'll give me some reward or recognition or acceptance or love. And if I don't do it, then I may get some punishment. And indeed, the world is seen very much like this by many of the religions, that God tells you what to do, and you have to do it to get rewarded, and you don't do it, you get punished. The countries also. This is your duty as a citizen. If you do it, you get rewarded. You don't do it, you get punished. And families, schools, employers. This is the general mood in the world. And this general mood is there because Durga means a fort. We're in this fort of the material energy. It is a prison. And in a prison, you have to do your duties or you get in a lot of trouble. So it's sort of that we're dragging, you know. We're like dragging this heavy ball and chain around with us in the form of this body, certainly. I'm still recovering from a bad cold and sore throat, so my voice sounds very odd. And I've been particularly feeling that my body is just this heavy burden that I'm carrying around. I'm walking around in my own prison. And then we're imprisoned on the planet. Right? There's so many attempts to leave the planet, but they're not very successful. People are trying to change their body, make it be more what they want to be by temporary or permanent modifications. Of course, all temporary. And trying to leave some place, trying to get free of these laws of nature, which give us these prescribed duties. And then we all, because we have a body, we all have prescribed duties to care for the body. And then we're being forced. Prabhupada says, what is your freedom? You're being forced. We're forced to feed the body, to give it liquids, to give it rest, to keep it clean, to keep it healthy. Otherwise, we have suffering. So when we apply this to God, it sounds really awful. You know, we think of prescribed duties all in this sort of obligatory and not generally pleasant. You know, sometimes it may be pleasant, but generally, even when it's pleasant to cook for your family, or even when it's pleasant to go to work, or even when it's pleasant to take a bath, there is always some degree of unpleasantness mixed with it. You know, it would be a lot nicer to have a body that didn't need to be bathed than that we could just, you know, take a bath when we wanted to for pleasure, but we weren't forced to. It would be nice if we weren't forced to drink water, forced to eat, etc., etc. So we apply this to God and we think the same way. We think, well, I'm forced to serve God out of a matter of duty. All right, I'll do it. You know, I'll do it because if I do it, I'll get some reward, and if I don't do it, I'll get some punishment. Yeah, that's how we look at duty. And for the vast majority of conditioned souls, such a way of thinking of things is probably obligatory. Probably do have to put things in that context. But that's not the kind of matter of duty that we want to get to. This obligation. And in fact, it's quite interesting. I've always found it fascinating that when Krishna talks about charity in the modes of material nature in the Bhagavad Gita, and he talks about that when charity is given at the request of a superior, it's in the mode of passion. And Srila Prabhupada in that purport says, when charity is given under obligation at the request of a superior or with regret afterwards, oh, why have I given this much? It's charity in the mode of passion. And we can think of charity not just as giving money to someone or something, but we can think of charity as giving any of our energy. After all, giving our money is simply a concrete form of our energy. Most people get money by working. And if you make $30 an hour, then $30 represents that hour of your physical and or mental energy. So it was really any giving of energy, any giving of things, Any giving of time, any giving of thought, and so forth, is a kind of charity. And when it's given under the sense of obligation at the request of a superior, just because I ought to and I really don't want to, that's not what we're aiming for. And that's not what Srila Prabhupada is propounding here. Of course, again, for average conditioned souls, we may say you have to offer respect to God as a matter of duty, just like you have to take care of your elderly parents and your children and, you know, disaster victims and so forth and so on, crippled people, as a matter of duty. You have to offer respects to those who are greater than you. You have to help those who are lesser than you. That's your duty, whether you want to or not. You can't just be selfish. But here, Prabhupada's aiming at something much higher than that. So I want to look at, what is he talking about? What is Srila Prabhupada talking about? And what is the mood here of Lord Brahma? So the basic principle, if we look at Bhagavatam 1.16.26, we will see that knowledge has several subcategories there. One of them is gratefulness. Another one is acting according to place, object, and time. And another one is knowing oneself. So in this context of offering respect to the Lord, we really look at gratefulness. That the Lord is giving us everything. Eko bahunam yo vidadati kama. Nichanichanam chaitanis chaitanam. Eko bahunam yo vidadati kama. Whatever we need, whatever we desire, is being supplied by the Lord. We often don't know what to desire. That's another interesting topic. But the fact is that whatever we are getting is what we desire, and whatever we desire, we are ultimately getting. So one should be very grateful to someone who's fulfilling all of our desires. And Krishna fulfills the desires even of the very demoniac living entities, even those who are angry at him, even those who hate him. Right, I often talk about the subterranean heavenly planets. I've just finished reading the fifth canto again. And it's fascinating how in the subterranean heavenly planets, there's only atheists. There's no religious people. There's no sun. There's plenty of light from the jewels on the heads of snakes, but there's no indication of the passing of time whatsoever. And the material opulences are very great. They're said to be greater than that of Indra's planet. And also, there's no fear from demons taking over because, well, they're already all demons, so it's a question of demons taking over, and the demigods aren't interested in these subterranean heavenly planets. And I thought that's exactly what atheists want. That's what they want. They want some kind of realm where everyone is an atheist. Well, no one will ever talk of God or religion. Well, you don't even have to have a sense of God in the form of time. You know, you don't have a sense of God in terms of the structure of the universe. You know, you can't, you're cut out of where you can see anything. And so you don't have a sense of your smallness in the universe, your dependence on time and so forth. And you can imagine that there's no God, until, of course, the Sudarshan Chakra comes and just... Yeah. So God is still there, of course. But it's what they want, that's my point. It's what they want, it's what they desire. And because they are pious and they're following the laws of the universe, Krishna gives them what they desire. Hiranyakashipu did his austerities to control the universe, and he got what he desired. So why should we not be grateful? Gratitude. Mahabharata talks about that the worst quality anyone can have is to be an ingrate. And I think that of all the things that disturb us, betrayal and ingratitude are at the top. You know, as C.S. Lewis said, a person can tolerate almost anything unless it's perceived as unfair. And anything that's ungrateful, you know, we do so much for someone and they don't even notice it. Such a thing is very common in people who live together all the time, work together all the time, that they just take for granted the work and the gifts of others. You know, well, it's my parents, my grandparents, my aunties and uncles, of course they should be giving to me. Or it's my children, of course they should be giving. My spouse, of course they should be giving. And we just have, and of course they should, and we don't feel grateful. And we find whenever someone doesn't feel grateful for us, it hurts. We expect at least that. We expect that at least our gifts and our time and our energy are acknowledged with some gratefulness. So that's a lot of where duty comes from, isn't it? Especially to those who are superior to us, which is what's the main thrust of today's verse. So our duty to those who are superior, just those who are giving us something, they're giving us shelter, they're giving us knowledge, and they're giving us food, and whatever they may be giving us, and they're giving us this often without expecting anything in return. I mean, what are we supposed to give to Krishna in return? You know, he gives us the sun and we offer him a ghee lamp. I mean, that's a joke, isn't it? Like I say, offering a palm full of water of the Ganges to the Ganges. Even you see these pujas at the Ganges where these brahmanas have these humongous, gigantic ghee lamps. I don't know how they hold them. You know, they're so heavy and they must be so hot. But even those are nothing. What are they compared to the sun? Nothing. What are we offering back? I mean, we're not, there's no way we're offering some kind of a price. It's just basically a token of gratitude. Right, the man buys his wife a full diamond jewelry set, you know, necklaces, bracelets, earrings, and so forth and so on. And she smiles at him in gratitude. So, and that's enough for him, you know, that my wife has smiled at me, my child has smiled at me. So this basic gratitude, a lot of what we call duty is gratitude. Then place, object, and time. So a lot of what we call duty is this kind of knowledge of what's the best thing to do according to individuals. Because just offering respect in the wrong way at the wrong time, you end up in the lower modes. And finally, knowing oneself. What is the real self? Because all of these other duties have to do with the false self. They are really duties like in a drama. So in a drama, if you're playing the role of a king, then you have so many duties as the king. But those duties are irrelevant once you're off the stage. They don't mean anything anymore. In some drama, you're somebody's child, you're somebody's husband, and you have duties, and dramatic duties, right? But off the stage, you don't have those duties. So ultimate duty, ultimate gratitude is coming from the self, the real self. What am I ultimately getting from Krishna, for which I should be grateful on the spiritual level? I'm ultimately getting an eternal life of unending bliss and knowledge. I'm ultimately getting a spiritual form, practically like God, residence in the spiritual world where all of my desires are fulfilled without any hard labor whatsoever, just simply by desiring them. And the company, the association of the Vrajajana Valava, of the other residents of Vrindavan who also have this love. So people in this world who want to avoid any kind of duty, they want to avoid any kind of gratefulness, they're stealing. I was trying to explain this to my 8-year-old grandson the other day. He was complaining about having to pick up the dirty dishes after a meal and put them in the sink. He has that job several days a week. And he's, oh, I don't like to do it, I don't like to do it. And I was saying, okay, well, you know, somebody's growing the food, somebody's going shopping, somebody's cooking the food, and you're spending 5 minutes doing this. I said, it's a way of saying thank you. I said, and if you don't do it, you're really stealing. You're not giving anything in return for what you're getting. So this is the avoidance of duty. Of course, even in such people, there may be what we call honor among thieves, right? Where the thieves say, let's divide this booty equitably. But the mood is taking. The mood is, how can I take? And this mood of how can I take and not do any duty is very, very dominant in the modern world. It's just across the board. You know, how can I be maintained by my parents and go to school and do nothing for them in return? How can I get knowledge from my teacher and not serve them in return? How can I, you know, enjoy sexual pleasure with other living entities without any commitment to take care of them, without any commitment to take care of children? How can I get money with the least amount of work possible? How can I get money by gambling? How can I get money by cheating? Right? This is how can I get health just by popping some pills instead of eating a healthy diet and exercising and so forth? How can I have a good, solid country just simply by voting for some bombastic fool rather than really working for the benefit of the country? On and on and on and on and on. The whole mood is that of stealing, how can I get something free or cheap? And we study in logic propaganda techniques, and one of them is free and bargain. We all get very excited. You know, how can I get something for free? How can I get something for free? How can I get it at a bargain? How can I get it at a bargain? We're very, very excited. If there's some advertisement, here's something very valuable, and you have to put in an amount of work and do your duty and earn it, then we're not so excited. Now I want a shortcut. So this is stealing. This is avoidance of duty. And then there's, of course, paying, but the idea of paying, I'm just thinking about getting something back. And here we have who's prescribing what to pay, so that's the government, the family, and so forth, and sometimes ourselves. We decide this is what I'm willing to pay for this. And these people are considered pious. But they're doing their duty to get something externally in the world that's very calculated. And then we have the people who do their duty just because it feels so good to do your duty. I mean, it does, doesn't it? When you know that you've cooked a nice meal for your family, you feel satisfied just, oh, I've done my duty. And it's the same way with God. The people worship God, and I've done my duty. I'm a good person. I'm a religious person. So that's a little higher than doing your duty just so you can enjoy the world. But the ultimate expression that Srila Prabhupada's urging us to go to here is where we're doing our duty out of love. And in that case, it doesn't really seem, you know, the word duty becomes a little funny in that case. Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Prichaja Mamekam Saranam Vrata Aham Tam Sarva Pate Yomokshi Shami Masaja. Give up all your other concepts of dharma, all your other concepts of duty. The only thing you need to do is surrender to me. And we also talk about that as dharma. Sarva Dharma, give up all dharma. We say Sanatan Dharma, our eternal dharma. So this kind of duty is on the basis of the self, of the real self. This kind of duty is not on the basis of, you know, do I happen to be French or Spanish or Indian, or do I happen to be male or female, or do I happen to be married or a parent, or are my elderly parents still living, and so forth. It's not based on that. It's based on I am a soul, and Krishna has given me everything. I am part of him, and I want to reciprocate with him, not even so much to show gratefulness. Gratefulness is focused on me. It may be very revolutionary, you know, for the people, for the thieves, an attitude of gratitude is a big step forward. But for those who are on the platform of love, they're not thinking about gratitude. They're not thinking about, wow, Krishna's done so much for me. But they're just in love with him for him. And therefore they say, whatever you do, you can trample me under your feet, you can be away from me, I still love you. I don't love you based on what you do for me, even if you seemingly do nothing for me, which of course is not possible, even if it seems that you do nothing for me, even if you don't fulfill any of my desires, whatever, even if you leave me to rot here in the material world forever, I still love you. And I still want to serve you and respect you and please you just for your happiness. And that is love. That is love. Now, who prescribes that duty? Interestingly enough, that really is prescribed by the self. I mean, we could say that all the other duties are ultimately prescribed by the self because of the self's desire to rebel against Krishna, ichidvesha. Therefore, the self has been put inside of a material body, as it says in the Bhagavatam, so many self-created duties. So, in an ultimate sense, even the duties prescribed to us by our family, our society, our nation, and the shastras and all this, the fact that we're under those laws is really due to our own desire, in a sense. Just like the criminals who are in the prison, they have prison duties to do. You could say, well, they wanted to go to prison. Well, they didn't really want to go to prison. They wanted to be criminals who didn't go to prison. So they wanted it and they didn't exactly want it. But when it comes to the spiritual, realized duties, that is really just coming from the soul. There's no prescribed rules like that, especially in Goloka Vrindavan. It's not like that. Bhakti Vinod Thakur says the only rules are to have love and don't envy, and there just aren't any other rules. I mean, in Vaikuntha there's some vidhi still, there's a sense of respect, and there's discussions of how do you talk to the Lord and how do you show respect to the Lord. But the more intimate one's love for the Lord, the more that everything is just spontaneous according to the desire of the living entity themselves. And this is exactly what we all want. Exactly what we all want. We want my sense of duty, what I should be doing, what I should be thinking, should, this word should. We want it to come from what I want to do. We want it to be entirely voluntary, moment by moment by moment, simply motivated out of love and pleasure, and not motivated out of any fear, not motivated out of any kind of calculation as to what someone's giving me and what I owe them and how I'm going to feel inside when I give it. And then we have this love that brings with it all the emotions, that all the emotions, all the anubhavs and the vyavicharibhavs flow from this love. So this is the real duty of the soul, and although the word duty can be used, Sanatana Dharma can be used, the meaning of Dharma in Sanatana Dharma is so radically different from the meaning of Dharma in Varnashram Dharma that it's actually interesting to even use the same word. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, in commenting on this verse, says that at first Lord Brahma was doing penances because he was afraid of time. He was afraid of that he would die. He has reference here in this verse to how long he's going to live. But once his heart opened up to bhakti, he was free from fear. And he was serving the Lord just out of love. So it could be that we're on a lower platform and we have to act under the sense of rules and obligations and fear of punishment and hope of reward. That may be, and very few people are free from that entirely. But we should aim for a place where we're not operating in that way. Not that we should imitate it, not that we should falsely claim it, but we should be aiming for it. That should be our desire, individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. And where the word duty is just something fun and exciting and coming, arising from the will of the living entity in relationship to loving Krishna. So thank you very much. If you have any questions or comments. Yes, Prabhu.
How to get from here to there.
How to get from the obligatory duty. Well, it's really interesting that in the Adi Lila, I'll see if I can find this quickly. I was looking at it yesterday, so I may be able to find it quickly. Okay, so in the Adi Lila 4:68, it says, the essence of the Ladini potency is love of God. The essence of love of God is emotion, bhava. And the ultimate development of emotion is mahabhava. And Srila Prabhupada says something very unusual and hard to understand, perhaps, in this purport. He says, there's two divisions of love of God, the Ladini Shakti, pure love of God and an adulterated love of God. And only when the Ladini Shakti emanates from Sri Krishna and is bestowed upon the living being to attract him, does the living being become a pure lover of God. But when the same Ladini Shakti is adulterated by the external material energy and emanates from the living being, it does not attract Krishna. On the contrary, the living being becomes attracted by the glamour of the material energy. So this gives us a little clue. This Ladini Shakti should come from Krishna, and coming from Krishna should enlighten our heart, Gyanati Pain Bhashvata. Working on Raghunathdas Goswami's Manashiksha, in the 8th verse, Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about the same principle. He says, without the mercy of the internal pleasure potency, no one can ever experience transcendental ecstasy called Paramananda, the supreme bliss of loving service. And he talks about a desire awakens in the heart by the grace of this Ladini Shakti, by the grace of Gandharva. So the only way that we come to this platform, there just isn't any other way, is that somebody else has to turn on the light. Yanadi Pain Vashvata. We can't really shine our own little flashlight or torch. I have a little, tiny little flashlight that I keep in my drawer. It's pretty powerful. But it won't light up a whole room. Somebody has to turn on the switch. So the switch is this Ladini Shakti of the Lord, that when it enters our heart, it lights up our heart, and it takes us to the platform beyond fear and desire, beyond desire and hatred, Ujjadvesha. It takes us to the platform of love. So how do we get that light to be shined in our heart? It has to come from Krishna. Krishna has to say, all right, my dear Ladini Shakti, my dear Gandharva, please take a ray and enter into this devotee's heart and light it up. So why does he decide to do that? Well, because we've asked him to. We've asked him to by our actions of engaging in Vayu Bhakti seriously. We've asked him to by our prayers. I would say most of all, we've asked him to by our humility, and especially our dealings with the other Vaishnavas. That we've shown him by how we deal with the other Vaishnavas, how we deal with correction, how we deal with the difficulties in life, that we're going to be receptive. You know, we all have experience with other human beings that we can say, oh, I brought you a gift. Here, let me show you what I brought you. And they look at it and they say, oh, I'm not interested. And sometimes we just don't understand it. This is such a nice gift. It will help you so much. Oh, I'm not interested. Or we go to another person and we say, hey, you have this problem. You have this thing you have to deal with. And they say, oh, I don't want to hear you. So it's our receptivity to the beautiful gifts of Krishna and our receptivity to the corrections coming up from Krishna directly and through other living beings and through the scriptures that determines how much he's going to turn on the light. Well, first he turns on the light a little bit and sees how we respond. You know, do we start awakening to love? And then what do we do? Do we run away from it? Do we reject it? Do we nourish it? And I think I can safely say that all, or the vast majority at least, of us in practicing Krishna consciousness, I think I can say all, have had experiences where some spiritual emotions have awakened in us, where there has been some real, genuine spiritual pleasure. Maybe it lasted for a moment, maybe it lasted for hours, maybe it lasted for a year or two. Maybe we were just absorbed in it. And, you know, how did we respond? Did we nourish it? Because if we nourish it and we go forward, and then we'll, the light will turn on more and more and more. Just like right now, we're getting close to sunrise here in Hawaii. You know, when I started speaking, the sky was very dark, and gradually it got light, and now, you know, things are not, you know, brightly lit, but you can see colors and pretty much see everything that you would want to see, although it's still kind of dim and hazy. So Haridas Thakur compares like that, after the chanting of the holy name, engaging in service is kind of like the sunrise. So yeah, any sincere performance of service will induce Krishna to send this beam of his pleasure potency of Gandharva. He'll say, enter into the heart and illuminate it. And then what do we do with it? How do we respond? Depending on how we respond, it goes slower or faster, or it may just kind of plateau. Or there's not really another way.
What if we notice that the...
Yeah?
I'm sorry, what if we notice that the light's going to dim?
I'm sorry, but somehow you're very faint and there was a car going by. Can you say it again?
What are we to think if we notice the light starts to dim? The light was brighter. We notice the light is starting to dim a little bit in our heart. What might be going on?
Well, sometimes Krishna seems to leave because he wants to increase our hankering for him and not take him for granted. And sometimes it's because we've committed an offense. It's usually one of those two reasons. In any case, you know, the cure is basically the same. Make sure that we rectify our offenses and increase our desire rather than becoming discouraged.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. I just, with your permission, wanted to state something. I had a long discussion maybe a couple of days ago with someone regarding what was our Srila Prabhupada's meaning when he spoke about Vaidhi Bhakti.
Mm.
And so doing a lot of the research, because, you know, of course, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's the verse there, Sakale Jagate Muri Vaidhi Bhakti, Vaidhi Bhakti Bhakti Nahi Shakti. That by the process of Vaidhi Bhakti, we would not be able to obtain the service of Radha, Krishna, and Braj. So the question arose, what was actually being spoken of when the term was being used very frequently, the practice of Vaidhi Bhakti? So after doing a lot of research, we understood that Srila Prabhupada was speaking more from the point of view of the verse, Shruti Smriti Puranadi, this verse saying that you cannot follow any kind of spiritual practice without rules and regulations. And even upon obtaining the practice of Raganuga Bhakti, is one verse, Shravanam Kirtan Bandhani, Vaidhi Bhakti Juganti too. Still, you have to follow rules and regulations. It's not that they will all be abandoned when the stage of Raganuga Bhakti comes. So Srila Prabhupada was emphasizing the need to follow the rules and regulations of scripture, and not to act whimsically like Sahaja do, or others who follow no rules and regulations of Sastra, not following any Ekadasi, not doing any rules and regulations regarding the association of men and women, like Sahajas do. So this was the meaning, but the technical term in Bhakti Sandarbha of the practice that we're doing in aspiration for the service of Radha and Krishna, which is which should have predominantly established, that we don't have any temples of Narayan, so to speak. So, for the most part, he was establishing what Jiva Goswami called as Raganuga Pravritti, or the practice of the rules and regulations of Sastra with the aim of establishing Raganuga for the practice of the devotee as his adhikar grows. So it was very helpful, because there was a lot of confusion to the point where some devotees were even saying, well, there's no such thing as Srila Prabhupada and Raganuga Bhakti, etc. Where, of course, Srila Prabhupada was really emphasizing the need to properly come into adhikar.
Well, that's certainly a very helpful way to look at it. We explore this subject rather deeply in the chapter on Bhakti Siddhanta, Manashiksha, and Raganuga Sadhana in our upcoming publication of Manashiksha. And the Gaudiya Math logo had two sides, one side for Vaidhi, called Vidhi, and one side for Raga. On the Vidhi side, it did indeed show Lakshmi Narayan on a throne, and Archana, Pancharatrik, and Archana. And on the other side, for Raga, it showed Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan. So there were deities of Lakshmi Narayan and then Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan with Bhagavatam, Kirtan, and a printing press. And you could say, and legitimately so, that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta and his disciple, A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada, in one sense engaged people in Raganuga Sadhana from day one, because their aspiration is for Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan, and their aspiration is not for Vaikuntha. Of course, some members may decide they want to go to Vaikuntha. We're not prohibiting anyone from going to Vaikuntha. But the general aspiration and the general mood is this attaining of Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan. So in one sense, you could say, because that's the goal, that it's not really ever Vaidhi Sadhana in the sense of having Vaikuntha as the goal. That's legitimate, and I know of a number of people who put it forward that way, and I think that's fine. However, at the same time, there is definitely a distinction between Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti and Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, even within the followers of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, there's definitely a difference. And it's not these, just like in these verses that I'm quoting, one's internal proclivity needs to awaken. And it can only awaken by this ray of the Ladini Shakti. It cannot be awakened artificially. A lot of what Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and later Srila Prabhupada were complaining about and criticizing were people who tried to imitate or manipulate or somehow externally, artificially claim to have a particular proclivity towards Krishna's eternal service. And that doesn't work at all. It has to awaken naturally by the Ladini Shakti. It cannot happen any other way. It's just like the sun rising, that you cannot force the sun to rise. So you could say, in the darkness of night, yes, we're waiting for the sun to rise. We are a planet that is nourished by the sun. Even at night, we're really nourished by the sun. Even at nighttime, if there was no sun at all, the whole planet would simply freeze. So although the sun is not visible, still our goal is the sun, and we're waiting for the sun. However, there is still a difference between the night and the sunrise. There's something that happens at a particular point in time when the sun begins to rise. And when the sun begins to rise, there's an entire difference in perception of all of our senses. You know, everything changes. And there is definitely a change that happens at that time. And the same thing with being awake or asleep. So Vaidhi Bhakti is something like doing the externals of bhakti while one is still asleep. Theoretically, one is going to say, I'm not this body. Theoretically, one's going to say, I'm not really a Chinese woman or an Indian man or something like that. But that's one's general consciousness. And until one starts to awaken to one's real identity, then the motives are quite different. So the motive in Vaidhi Bhakti is scriptural rules. What's the prescribed duties? What's my sense of prescribed duties in Vaidhi Bhakti? Even if my aim is Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan, still my sense of prescribed duty is coming from the Shastras. The Shastras say, I should do this, therefore I do it. I made this vow to my guru that I'm going to do it, therefore I'm going to do it. That's what's driving me. It's what's motivating me. My inner motivation is, this is what it says. The Shastras say, it makes logical sense to me. I was just looking at someone's research on why people join the movement, and the predominant reason was the philosophy, way over and above everything else. So we hear a philosophy that makes logical sense to us, that inspires us, that enlivens us, and on the basis of that philosophy, we start the process. Srila Prabhupada talks so much in so many places about how Krishna is the Supreme Lord. Krishna is Tu Bhagavan Swayam. Not that Paratram Nanya. That Krishna is the source of Vishnu. That Krishna is above all the demigods. It, over and over and over again. One should worship Krishna because he's the Supreme Lord. So we become convinced intellectually and logically that Krishna is the Supreme Lord, and we know we're supposed to be grateful to the Supreme Lord, and therefore we worship him. We worship him with the aim of spontaneous love. But that's not exactly what's pushing us. We don't have those feelings of spontaneous love. We may have some feelings of attraction in a general way to Krishna, and affection in a general way to Krishna. You know, we have some idea of a relationship in a general way. You know, I'm the servant of my guru, I'm the servant of mission, and so forth. But that's Vaidhi Bhakti in the sense that what's driving us are the Vidhi. Then at a certain point, that's not true anymore. At a certain point, we awaken, and our natural feelings towards Krishna start to be visible in our heart. And we feel towards Krishna, oh, he is my son. Oh, he is my beloved. He is my friend. And then the reason that one is doing something, one may still be following all the rules of the scriptures. So externally, it doesn't look any different. But internally, what's driving one is completely different. And it gets to the point that the devotee doesn't even care whether or not Krishna is God. So at first, whether or not Krishna is God is the whole question. has so much time and energy. Is Krishna God? You know, I had a devotee say to me, well, maybe Shiva's God. You know, there's a Shiva Purana where Shiva's God. There's the prayers to Shiva in the eighth canto where Shiva isn't. Maybe Shiva's God. Maybe it's not Krishna. Maybe it's really Narayana. How do you know? But when raga starts to awaken, you don't really care. So maybe Shiva is higher. Who cares? I love Krishna. Maybe Narayana is higher. I don't care. I love Krishna. I want to be with Krishna. And why am I chanting my rounds? I'm chanting my rounds because I want to please Krishna. I want Krishna to smile. I want to enter into my relationship with Krishna. You know, I want to wrestle with Krishna and the other boys in the fields, or I want to cook, you know, milk sweets for Krishna and feed him, or I want to decorate groves with flowers or whatever it might be. And that's why you're chanting, because that's already awakened. I mean, Prabhupada sometimes compares it to the old system of marriage, where, you know, the parents introduce the young boy and girl to someone, and at first there may not be feelings. Well, sometimes there would be. Sometimes they look at each other and immediately there's feelings. But they introduce to each other, generally at a young age, when there are feelings, and they're just following the rules of the parents. And the girl is with the boy, and the boy is with the girl because they trust that their parents have done the research, that the parents have researched the family, the parents have researched the astrology, the parents have, you know, taking their own personal feelings into consideration, and out of trust from the parents, they're going ahead with the relationship. And the idea is, I'm sure it doesn't always happen, but the idea is that after some time of being in the relationship, they're no longer in the relationship because this is the person that my mother who loves me picked for me. That they're in the relationship because they love that person. And they're no longer thinking, is this the best possible person in the world that I could be with? You know, they're there because they're there, and because this is who they love. And again, this is our material experience across the board. You know, that when there's love, once love awakens in us, then we're not really being motivated by logic and by have-tos anymore. It's not like that. Of course, love in this world is contaminated and temporary, but we have some idea of that. You know, a boy in love with a girl. So he's buying her gifts, not because he's following a rule book, and not because, you know, his mother says, you know, you really should buy your wife a gift, but because he just wants to. So that distinction is definitely there. And we have to say, it's not something that we would like to say, but something that we have to say, that has to awaken in this life in order to attain to Goloka. If one is simply following the rules externally with the aim of Goloka, but this never awakens and one never acts on it, then one's still in the mood of vidhi, more or less. Now, if one's aim is Goloka, one's not going to be cheated and go to Vaikuntha, although one can go from Vaikuntha to Goloka, as evidenced in the Brihadbhagavatamrita, and as Prabhupada mentions in the Nectar of Goloka. So one could do that. But to enter into Goloka, our feelings for Krishna in Goloka have to awaken. You can say, well, that's problematic, because you already said that that's not under our control. It has to come from Krishna. It's something like turning from a boy to a man or a girl to a woman. It's not really under our control. You know, if you're a late bloomer and you mature at 17, you know, you can take artificial hormones, I suppose. But it's not really something you can do. You have to wait. You know, if you're in a part of the world where the sun rises at 10 in the morning, you just have to wait. You can't force it. But what can you do? There are things that you can do to induce the Lord to want to awaken those things in you. First of all, you can want it. Really, really want it. Not want it as something theoretical because everybody else in my religious group said I should want it. And therefore, yes, it's what I'm supposed to be wanting, but really what I just want is a new car. Or really what I just want is liberation. One can start cultivating one's desires for it. How do we do that? Well, associate with other people who have those desires. associate with other people who talk about Krishna, who talk about Vrindavan, who talk about the devotees of Vrindavan. Don't associate with fault finders and politicians. And read. Prabhupada wanted us to read Krishna book every night before we went to bed. He gave us Krishna book in the early in the movement. Read Krishna book. Read it over and over and over again. Read the Bhagavatam. Read the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And meditate on what one reads. Don't read as some kind of, you know, ritual. But really think about it and have it hone one's desires. Have it affect one's desires. And whatever light the Lord shines in our heart in any way, shape, or form, to respond to it with eagerness and humility. If the Lord shines a light in our heart about some anartha we need to give up, then give it up. You know, respond to the Lord's enlightening us, however he's enlightening us, and then if we respond to that properly, then the day will come when he'll begin to enlighten us with who we are. And if we don't do that, if we don't respond to the lights the Lord shines in our heart, if we don't rightly pick our association, if we don't really try to hear about Vrindavan, then, you know, Bhagunam Janmanamante Janamam Prapajate Vasudevam Sarayuti Samahatma Sidhuri Bahad. Then it becomes just Niyamagraha. And it becomes seeing the chanting of the holy name as some kind of ritualistic formula for attaining to the ultimate heaven. And that's not what we want. Is that all right?
Hare Krishna, how are you, baby?
Hi, yeah, Krishna.
Sorry to be with you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your contribution. Yes, thank you. Yes.
Along those lines, do you want to say something about the exalted devotee that's going to be at your son's house this evening and how important it would be for devotees in East Hawaii to get her darshan?
I think that's better done just over the sanghas that deal with the people who live locally, and that's not really appropriate for an international Skype conference.
Okay.
But thank you for bringing that up. Anybody else?
I kind of hesitate to ask this question because maybe I should have been paying attention more, but as far as prescribed duties, whenever I read that phrase, I didn't exactly understand what it was. You know, years went by and I just kind of glossed over it, and I just accepted it means whatever's there in the Shastra. In your class somehow or other, I'm just confused. It sounded more like what, it's not just what's written in the Shastra, but it's what's like written in your heart. Or did I miss something?
Well, ultimately, that's our only prescribed duty in the ultimate level is what's written in our heart in terms of our desire to serve Krishna in love. That's ultimately our only prescribed duty. And it's really scribed by us, by our own particular flavor of love of Krishna. It is entirely coming from our voluntary, spontaneous desire to serve Krishna in a particular way. Yes, ultimately that is our only prescribed duty, and one for whom that prescribed duty is fully blossomed has no other duties in the world. Even those written in the Shastra. As Krishna says, such a person has no reason to perform their duties nor any reason to give them up. And we find in the Shastras that people who realize what duty is written in their heart on the spiritual level may sometimes give up all their external duties. I mean, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu left his widowed elderly mother, his 16-year-old wife, to take sannyas. That's, from a mundane point of view, that's not very nice. I mean, Krishna says to Vasudeva and Devaki that anyone who can maintain their elderly relatives but fails to do so, or anyone who can maintain a chaste wife and fails to do so, that they're going to go to hell. And it's really scary what Krishna says to Vasudeva and Devaki about people who are negligent in their family duties. But as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was. The gopis just left their husbands and babies and Oh, Krishna's calling. So the yogic Brahmanis also. Even many of us who join the Hare Krishna movement, whether we're from India or from America or from Paris, in many cases it meant displeasing our parents or our spouses or somebody. It was usually very upset with us. And we said, oh, too bad, I'm going to Krishna. This is my real duty. Now, generally, even for persons who've awakened to their inner spiritual duty, Krishna wants them, yad yada charti shesta, to do the external duties. Just to set an example and to have some service that they're doing for Krishna in the world. But they're no longer doing them because they're their duties according to the body. They're doing them because Krishna is personally asking them to do them. So that's on a different level. For those who haven't fully come to the point of realizing their spiritual duties, then you do have duties in the world. We are, what's prescribed for us is according to our level of realization and understanding. This is very nicely described by Bhaktivinoda Thakura in the Niyamagraha section of Bhakti Loka, that there's different rules according to your level of awakening, according to your level of realization, and that one should neither act below their realization nor above it. Does that clarify things?
Very much so. Thank you. As I was saying, for years I just glossed over the term without understanding.
Yeah, isn't that funny that Srila Prabhupada uses it so much, but in the modern day it just doesn't even make sense to anybody. You know, what is he talking about? Anyway, I hope that this was at least somewhat helpful, and sorry for my low volume, scratchy voice. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.